Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have John M. Efron, who is the Corrett Professor of Jewish History at the University of California, Berkeley. He's here to talk about his new book, German Jewry and the Allure of the Sephardic, published this year by Princeton University Press. Thanks very much for joining us, John.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
First off, we'll just start with, if you could tell us how you came to write this book.
Sure. I have been long interested in aesthetics and the Jewish body. And the latter were the subject of two books that I wrote. The first book was called Defenders of the Race, Jewish Doctors and Race Science in Fin de Siècle Europe. And then I followed that up with another book called Medicine and the German Jews, A History. And so both of those books were in some way about the appearance of Jews, the physical appearance in particular of Jews, their corporealization, the idea of Jews as an embodied people. And in the course of the first book, Defenders of the Race, which was really about the work of Jewish physical anthropologists at the end of the 19th century and their response to racial anti-Semitism and the way they used their own training to counter the claims of anti-Semitic race science. In the course of doing that book, I became very aware of anthropological descriptions of both Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jewry, and the way that those descriptions differed significantly from one another. That is to say, the Sephardim were almost always portrayed positively, with a special stress on their beauty, while Ashkenazic Jewry was portrayed in almost the exact opposite. That is to say, their lack of beauty, or portrayed as being ugly, crude physical features, etc. And I published an article in the Leo Beck Yearbook, which is the principal venue for the study publications, principal venue where work on the history of German-speaking Jews is published. And I published that in 1993, with a special emphasis just on these physical descriptions. And then I, you know, after some years and doing other work, I came back to this subject and found that the depictions of Sephardic Jewry by German Jews extended far beyond the anthropological and went off in many, many, many areas. And those other areas, including the anthropological, form the basis of the book German Jewry and the Allure of the Sephardic.
Right. So we'll get sort of a little bit more in depth into that in a second. But I thought as sort of background to the main arguments of your book, if you could tell us about the social and legal position of German Jewry in the late 18th century, which is sort of where your story begins.
Sure. The book begins in the late 18th century, as you say, and it extends up until around 1900. So it's a period of about 120 years. Now, at the beginning of that period, German Jewry was what I would call a traditional Jewish community, a religious Jewish community. It was overwhelmingly poor, and it was part of what I would call a much larger pan-Ashkenazic Jewish world in Europe. That is to say, there wasn't much difference in a meaningful way between Eastern European and Central European Jewry. There were differences that were determined by local custom, But by and large, these were sort of interchangeable communities. That is to say, Polish Jews sent their sons to yeshivot in Germany and vice versa. There was much intermarriage between the two communities, significant commercial links between the two communities. And culturally, they were of a piece. Both of them, for example, spoke Yiddish, two different kinds, a Western Yiddish and an Eastern Yiddish, but nonetheless, Yiddish nonetheless. There's one exception to this portrait that I've just drawn, and that is the Jews of Berlin in the late 18th century. Small in number, about 3,500. And unlike the rest of the Jews in Germany, they tended to be better off, if not wealthy, because they were tolerated. And by tolerated, that is what I mean is that is a legal category. They were protected, tolerated Jews. That is to say, they had letters of patent and permission to live in Berlin and trade in certain areas. And those letters of patent were, or letters of protection, they were also known as, were only granted to Jews with a certain income level. And it is those Jews who led this phenomenon of idealizing Sephardic Jewry. What happened is this pan-Ashkenazic world begins to collapse towards the end of the 18th century with the advent of Hasidism in Eastern Europe. Hasidism never crosses the border from Poland into Germany. And simultaneously, the other major marker of identity, aside from religion, is, of course, language. And German Jewry begins the slow but inexorable transition away from Yiddish to German, whereas Eastern European Jews continued to speak Yiddish. So in those two major areas, the two communities began to diverge, both in the religious sense and in the linguistic sense. And in the process of distinguishing themselves from the much larger Jewish communities of Poland, in Poland in the late 18th century had over 750,000 Jews. It was a gigantic community, a powerful community. In the process of distinguishing themselves from Polish Jewry, it's at that moment that they began to invoke medieval Sephardic Jewry as a model of an ideal community that they believed that they could in some way emulate. That is to say, not copy. They never wanted to be anything other than German Jews. So they didn't want to be Sephardim. They didn't want to engage in Sephardic practices. But they looked at Sephardic Jewry as an ideal community with one foot planted firmly in the dominant Spanish or secular culture, European culture, or in this particular case, Muslim culture, and another foot firmly planted within Jewish tradition. And that suited them as an ideal form of a Jewish community, and they sought to emulate those traits that they saw in medieval Sephardic Jewry.
Right. Yeah, so you've already touched on this a little bit. If you could, in chapter one, you sort of outline the growing German Jewish disdain for Yiddish, mm-hmm. and also at the same time a growing veneration of Hebrew. Yeah. And if you could tell us a bit about why language was so important here, and also particularly about how there was this advocacy for Sephardic over Ashkenazic mode of Hebrew pronunciation.
Sure. What makes the relations between German Jews and Eastern European Jews so fraught, I think, lies in language. And that is to say, the very proximity of German to Yiddish made German Jews hyper self-vigilant, fearful that they would be thought of as speaking Yiddish, not speaking correct German. And it was a kind of, led to a kind of a, paranoia is too strong a word, but it's something in that realm where other Jewish communities, whether it's a French Jewish community or an Anglophone Jewish community, never experienced that kind of reaction to Yiddish, because those dominant languages, English and French, are so far removed from Yiddish that it never posed a sort of a threat. But the same cannot be said of German. And so that adds a certain tension to the relationship between German Jews and Eastern European Jews. And to answer the second part of your question, is why in the 18th century did German Jews begin to express a preference for Sephardic pronunciation of Hebrew? That too is rooted in language and has to do with Yiddish, and that is that the Ashkenazic pronunciation of Hebrew reminded them too frequently of the way Hebrew words in Yiddish were pronounced. So one way to, what they sought to do was to both eliminate the use of Yiddish and eliminate the use of Ashkenazic Hebrew, and it was no accident that those two things occurred at exactly the same time.
In chapter two, you move to talk about the development of a discourse which promoted a view of Sephardim as the most physically beautiful Jews. Could you tell us a bit about this?
Yeah, so this is the chapter that deals with comportment and deportment. And this was extremely important to German Jews. By the way, I want to make one thing very clear, because some people have asked me about this. When I speak about Sephardim, I mean actual Sephardim. That is to say, of the Sephardim of medieval Spain, of the Golden Age, which went from about 900 to 1100. Those are the... That is the community that the German Jews of the 18th and 19th century are referring to. They're not referring to contemporary Sephardic Jews, let's say in what had been the Ottoman Empire, nor are they referring to what we would call today Mizrahim, Jews of Middle Eastern lands. They're only referring to the Jews of Spain, say between 900 and 1100. And that community was portrayed by German Jews as being intellectually, aesthetically, and in fact even physically beautiful, more beautiful than Ashkenazic Jews. And, of course, what the twist in the tale of all of this is that this promotion of Sephardic beauty and Sephardic superiority was being made by Ashkenazic Jews. Right? It's being made by these German Jews, all of whom are Ashkenazim. Now, Sephardim themselves had a long-established tradition of declaring their own superiority vis-a-vis Ashkenazic Jewry. But the story that I'm telling in this book is about the promotion of Sephardic superiority by Ashkenazic Jewry. By German Jews. And so already in the 18th century, we begin to see in certain Hebrew and German language journals, Jewish ones, biographical portraits of what they used to refer to as great men of the nation, by which they mean sort of Sephardic Jews. And poets like Yehuda Halevi, of course, Maimonides, Ibn Ezra, and Don Isaac Abravanel. These were people who were regularly the subject of mini biographies in the German Jewish press, as I say, both Hebrew language and German language press, where their virtues were extolled, their achievements were celebrated. And they were set up again as models of ideal Jews. And the thing that perhaps attracted German Jewry to them more than anything was not so much their intellectual achievements. For example, Isaac Abravanel was a biblical exegete, but an extremely conservative man. That wouldn't have appealed to them too much. But what really did attract German Jews was the ability of these Sephardic Jews to interact with the non-Jewish world, that they basically knew what to do in public. They spoke the dominant language. They could speak Spanish with non-Jews. They could engage in philosophical debate, in diplomacy, in high-level commerce. All of those things, that ability to function outside of the narrow confines of Jewish society, was what really attracted German Jews to them more than anything else, I think. And that required, on the part of Spanish Jewry, a certain ability to comport themselves, to have a kind of a stature, a standing, a way of being. And I mean this in a sort of a physical sense, that they could be in company that wasn't just Jewish. And so that chapter two of my book deals with the portrait of Spanish Jews as drawn by German Jews in the 18th and 19th century, with a special emphasis on the way they carried themselves. It was all about their bearing. And this idea of their being presentable, the German word is salonfähig, that they could keep company in the salons of Europe, as it were, that they're capable of behaving themselves in public. And by public is meant non-Jewish public. They wouldn't embarrass themselves. Mm. And that is what German Jewry, as it began its own process of self-fashioning and self-actualization that begins in the 18th century as they begin to split away from Eastern European Jewry, that's what they wanted for themselves, this ability to carry themselves among non-Jews. And so that's why we see these rhapsodic portraits of, we read these rhapsodic portraits of Spanish Jewry and the beautiful way they held themselves.
Yes, that's what's very interesting. So we'll move on and talk about chapter three, which is where you focus on Jewish architecture, particularly in the 19th century. And you suggest there was a building boom of new synagogues built in an entirely fictitious Sephardic design. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a bit about what was this design? How did it come about? And what was its broader meaning for German Jewish identity?
Yes, sure. So first of all, there was a building boom. It wasn't just synagogues. As German Jewry grew in numbers in the 19th century, they began, like other Jewish communities pretty much all over the world, they began to leave rural areas and move to the cities. And in moving to the cities, their population, you know, the population density of Jews in any one particular location grew, of course, and they needed new facilities. And so what we see in the 19th century in Germany is a massive boom, building boom of Jewish infrastructure, Jewish schools, Jewish community centers, hospitals, schools, cemeteries, ritual bathhouses, mikvot, and the like. And one aspect of the building boom were the new synagogues that were built. And this is an interesting and unusual part of the story, because the call to abandon Ashkenazic pronunciation of Hebrew in favor of Sephardic, or the publication of belles lettres and novels and poems that we perhaps get to later on in the discussion, all of those are really meant for internal consumption. But architecture, by its very nature, meant that this was the only expression of a kind of Sephardic mystique or an allure of the Sephardim that was constructed, and I mean that literally and figuratively, constructed together with non-Jews. Because, you know, the granting of permits to build were by the non-Jewish authorities. There were very few Jewish architects, hardly any Jewish architects in Germany in the 19th century. And so almost all of the architects, bar one, of the new synagogues that were built by non-Jewish architects. So this was a real sort of partnership between city and Jewish community, between non-Jewish architect and Jewish congregations. And all of the buildings, the new Jewish buildings that were built, as I mentioned, the schools and community centers and the like, were all built in sort of the regnant style of whatever that city had as its as its predominant building style. Very often that was neo-Gothic. And in Germany in the 19th century, there was a debate as to what the ideal national style of architecture should be. And it was a debate that went on in the architectural journals for decades. And architects were split between whether it should be neoclassical or neo-Byzantine or a neo-Gothic style of architecture. And the Jews probably, like Jews everywhere else, would have liked to have built in the dominant style, and that was very frequently neo-Gothic, but they were told that that was a German Christian national style of architecture and inappropriate for a synagogue. But they said, we will help you find a Jewish national style of architecture for these new synagogues that had to be built for these growing Jewish communities. And the style that many of these non-Jewish architects came up with was the neo-Moorish style, or sort of a neo-Islamic style. So we had built spectacular synagogues with minarets and crenellations and very ornate domes that borrowed from a whole slew of styles, but the predominant one would be the sort of neo-Moorish style. Of course, they bore absolutely no resemblance to what were probably very, very small, rather plain synagogues in Spain, between the years of 900 and 1100. These were built in Berlin and Leipzig, and they were gigantic synagogues that sat 2,000 people. So this was an imagined aesthetic all the way along, but nonetheless, they were truly spectacular edifices that came about at a time when, bear in mind that German Jews were not yet emancipated. That doesn't happen until 1871. And one of the accusations that was launched at Jews very frequently by those who thought they shouldn't be emancipated was that they were a foreign and oriental people. That was the word that was always used to describe them, oriental. And that is to say non-European. And yet they built these synagogues that really reaffirmed their foreign, oriental, quote-unquote, origins. So that's a very interesting aspect of this. And I think that the reason that they built them in this style is that they really made a statement that you may as well emancipate us because we're going nowhere. They're really rather defiant. And they run counter to a sort of a very common depiction of German Jews as pliant and as well, always prepared to toe the line, but they really are a statement of permanency and an unwillingness to yield and an unwillingness to remain in a state where they don't have legal rights. And so they were presented to these cities in many ways, I think, as a fait accompli. That is to say, we're here, we're going nowhere, so you may as well emancipate us. And that's, in fact, what ended up happening. And I think the other thing that was important as to why this style of neo-Moorish architecture was chosen is that it's utterly without precedent. There were no neo-Moorish synagogues like this ever in Jewish history. And I think that that was what their appeal was. That is to say, they're without precedent, they're entirely new, and they are befitting a community that sees itself as starting afresh, starting anew. German Jewry may have had in a very long past, of course, the first mention of Jews in Germany we have is actually from Roman times, from 321, from the city of Cologne. But nonetheless, the German Jewry that we sort of come to know is a community that really emerges in the 18th century. And so it's new, and these synagogues are new edifices for a new community, hopefully, and many of them were Reform synagogues, also a new form of Jewish religious expression. And so their unprecedented nature appealed to the creative energies of a community that is just beginning to emerge and find its own feet and distinguish itself from the much larger Ashkenazic world.
That's great. So in chapter 4, you examine the depiction of Sephardim in German Jewish popular culture, particularly looking at novels, poems, and short stories. These were often fast-paced adventure stories. Could you tell us a bit more about this and what they represented, these stories?
So I think that the spread of this idea of Sephardic beauty, Sephardic superiority, and the popularization of Sephardic culture was best expressed through popular literature. And these, as you say, short stories and poems and short novels were all serialized, and they appeared in the German Jewish press. And so, you know, every Friday when the Jewish newspaper would come, people would look forward every week to the next installment of these rather gripping tales. What's interesting about them, of course, is that very few of them are actually set during the Golden Age that I've been speaking about, that is the Golden Age under Islam. And I guess it's because, you know, good news doesn't sell. And so they tend to be set just at that moment when of the Reconquista, with the reconquest of Spain by the Catholics that displaces Muslim rule of Spain. And that begins the Jewish tragedy, of course, that culminates in 1492 with the expulsion of the Jews. And so what we have are these tales that are typically Victorian in nature, Jewish damsels in distress, very cruel inquisitors, heroic actions by Jews to save Jews, you know, who have been sent to the stake. And all of these things, you know, all of the elements of melodrama captivated the Jewish public in ways that that show that German Jewry also had itself, you know, a popular culture, that it wasn't all high culture, that these novels and these short stories really gripped the population, and I think was key. Really key to spreading the idea about Sephardic Jewry, and that with a Jewry that is in decline, as portrayed in this Belles Lettres, German Jewry stood poised to become the next great Jewish civilization. Mm. they're pictured at this moment of their tragedy. In the good old days of Muslim Spain are no more, and Ferdinand and Isabella have led the Reconquista, the Jewish tragedy and suffering of the Spanish Jews is underway. And so the next great bright spot on the horizon for a European Jewish community, the implication of that is that the next great bright spot would be Germany itself, where reason would prevail, because reason did prevail in Spain under the Muslims, and it was displaced by the unreason of fanaticism of Ferdinand and Isabella, culminating, as I say, in the expulsion.
That's really very interesting.
So those stories make German Jews feel good about their own contemporary situation. Of course, they're in the heart of Europe. They're in a country that is a country that leads the world in science. That its universities are the envy of the world. The German Jewry itself is becoming, you know, a solidly middle-class, bourgeois, highly, highly educated Jewish community. And so that stands in stark contrast to the portrayal of Spanish Jewry in their hour of great need and deprivation.
This sort of leads us into the next chapter, which is about German Jewish historians. And today we have this very common idea of this period of medieval Spain being a golden age for Jewry. Can you tell us a bit about this? You locate this idea of the golden age as coming particularly from this period of German Jewish history writing. Can you tell us a bit about how and why this image was constructed by German Jewish historians?
Sure. So in the 19th century, we begin to get the first Jewish historians. History wasn't a discipline that was practiced by Jews before the 19th century. And the first historians really emerge in Germany around 1820. And very often the focus of Jewish historical studies in the 19th century was on the golden age of Spanish Jewry. Remember that the 19th century for Europeans in general, particularly in Central and Western Europe, were besotted by the Middle Ages, which is why you get Neo-Gothic architecture everywhere. So, for example, you know, you're at Melbourne University. So Melbourne University has its Neo-Gothic architecture. So there's a celebration, and other parts of Melbourne do as well. So there's a celebration of the Neo-Gothic in the Middle Ages. Well, the traditional view was that for Jews in Central Europe, the Middle Ages was nothing to write home about. There was nothing to really celebrate. It was a period of unremitting suffering, blood libels, crusades, charges of host desecration, well poisoning. It goes on and on and on. Yet there is one bright spot, as portrayed by historians, and that was the Spanish Golden Age. And so Jews were able to say, we also have our glorious medieval period. To be sure, it wasn't ours, that is to say, that of Central European Jewry, but there was a Jewish community that enjoyed a glorious medieval past, and it was Spanish Jewry. So there's a focus on that. Now, also, Spanish Jewry is, it's not entirely concocted. Of course, you did have philosophy, rabbinics, and other great achievements by this community. But, of course, the way it was portrayed by the historians, you would think that everyone, every Jew in Spain was, you know, a Hebrew grammarian, a philosopher, a courtier, a poet, a doctor. And of course, it was a small minority of people. But that minority of high achievers was taken and portrayed as being representative of the entire community as a whole. And the historians were really responsible for explaining why it was that you had in this period such a high-achieving Jewish community. And the reason they invariably gave was that it was living in the tolerant environment of Islam that allowed Jews to fulfill their aspirations and fulfill their God-given potential. And so in many ways, what the historians were saying, the 19th century German Jewish historians were saying, was they were not only just telling stories about medieval Jews that were stories worth celebrating, but they were also talking to their contemporary Germans as well in the 19th century, because many of these historians, say someone like Heinrich Goetz, the greatest historian of the 19th century, Jewish historian, were teaching in rabbinical seminaries like the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau, when in fact, with their qualifications and their abilities, they actually felt that they should be teaching at places like the University of Berlin or Tübingen or Göttingen or something like that. And so what they're saying is, you Germans, you should take a leaf out of the Muslims of medieval Spain, because they were an ideal host society where Jews were given an opportunity to advance and progress and achieve their fullest potential. And so instead of restricting us to teaching in our day, instead of restricting us to teaching in Jewish seminaries and not giving us our full rights, you should be more like the Muslims of medieval Spain that accorded Jews their rights and be more like them. Now, of course, that entailed a tremendous exaggeration of just how tolerant the dominant society was in medieval Spain. It wasn't quite as rosy as they made it out to be.
Well, that's a very interesting summary of your book. I think hopefully we've managed to do justice to it, at least partially. If you could tell us a little bit about your next research project.
So the next research project is very different, entirely different. I'm interested in writing a book on the history of meat in Germany as it pertains to Jews. It's a very, very long history whereby meat is both in real terms and symbolic terms the great serves as the great divide between Jews and non-Jews, both in terms of social relations, the ability of Jews to eat with non-Jews, but also issues to do with charges of the way meat is slaughtered led to charges of cruelty, but it led to counter charges by Jews that shchita, or the Hebrew word for Jewish animal slaughter, is the most humane method of slaughter. So you get charge and then counter charge by Jews. But it also serves as a dividing line between Jews themselves, that is to say, those who continue to observe dietary restrictions and those who don't. So there's a whole history that begins already in probably in the 1600s, 15 and 1600s, I would say, the early modern period that goes through to the very end, into the 20th century. Issues to do with the banning of ritual slaughter in the 19th century, or attempts to have it banned, animal rights societies were really very anti-Semitic, and used the issue of animal slaughter to launch an assault against Jews, where the concerns were clearly not, they were dressed up as being out of concern for the animals, but the way animals were treated in non-Jewish abattoirs was really quite despicable. And if they were really that concerned, they would have had better conditions in those places. So it was really an excuse for something else. And then you also have, you know, religious issues in the 19th century with the advent of Reform Judaism. And so the issues of dietary restrictions, kashrut, were open to dispute, open to discussion. And so, that will form part of our discussion in this book about how Jews, you know, reacted to one another. And what the relevance was of the dietary laws in the 19th century. Were they outmoded? Were they still relevant? You also had the rise of 19th century Protestant biblical criticism in the 19th century that had very, very long discussions about issues to do with animal sacrifice in ancient Israel. So that will also be another subject of this book. I've only just started it. I'm at the very beginning stages of the research. But those are some of the topics that that will make up the study, I hope.
Great. Well, that sounds very interesting, and we'll certainly, once that project is completed, we'd certainly love to have you on New Books in Jewish Studies again to talk to us about that.
That would be my pleasure.
Great. Well, thank you very much again for your time. John, so we've been speaking to Professor John M. Efron about his new book, German Jewry and the Allure of the Sephardic, published by Princeton University Press this year, 2016. And it's an absolutely fascinating book, as you've hopefully been able to hear some of. So I definitely recommend getting your hands on a copy. So thanks very much again, John.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.